SJAV.
Good morning. May it please the court, Richard Lechick on behalf of the appellant, Montel Jackson. I'll reserve 3 minutes.
Three?
Yeah.
Very well.
Although incarcerated, Mr. Jackson hoped to be a father to his son. The state, however, thwarted his attempts to give him a relationship with his son, denying him services and visitation. At the termination trial, Mr. Jackson testified about the joy he experienced in the brief moments
he shared. How did they deny him services?
The department, as soon as the social worker learned that Mr. Jackson was incarcerated, went to court to obtain an order modifying the provision of visitation to remove it and to remove its obligation to provide services, and opposed Mr. Jackson, when he finally obtained counsel, to reinstitute the department's duty to provide services and to make reasonable efforts to provide visitation.
With respect to visitation?
With respect,
but the record shows that she continued to try to connect him with services both at Walla Walla and at
Cedar Creek.
Cedar Creek.
The social worker did make efforts on her own, but I'll direct your court to the orders of dependency, which came after that in March and April, and what the court says in terms of services and visitation says does not apply. Well, actually, it did apply. Had it applied, the court might have reviewed whether the social worker was making reasonable efforts to provide services and visitation. But the court simply, I guess, shrugged its shoulders and said, well, we have an order that he doesn't get visitation, and it would be futile to provide him services. So I think that shows that the department did deprive Mr. Jackson of services and visitation in manifest contravention of the 2013 Incarcerated Parents Act, which, if anything, was designed to address this exact problem, where the department thinks it's appropriate to just throw away the key and say, well, he's incarcerated. That's a de facto termination. We don't have to provide him services. You know, why would we want to give him visitation now since we're moving to terminate? That's exactly what the 2013 law was supposed to prevent. And I think under that law, the trial court's ruling that the department had no obligation to provide services or visitation was an abuse of discretion and absolutely.
But on this record, the social worker contacts them, and what were the things that were indicated? Parenting classes, drug, alcohol screening or testing. There was a third one. She inquired about all three at Walla Walla. She inquired at the second institution. There were limited things. There were problems with deliveries, what the record shows. How is that not addressing the identified services that he would have needed?
Well, the record also shows from the counselor's testimony that service providers could come on to the facilities and provide assessments of Mr. Jackson, and that actually your analysis, which was were ordered, which is part of the drug assessment, were available. So that the social worker really took on a cursory inquiry about, you know, what services does your facility have, and that was just about
But those services would be provided by the institution, wouldn't they?
They could be, or the institution would permit the department to bring in service providers to assess Mr. Jackson.
Okay, but was that the role of the counselor or the social worker?
That was the role.
Once they were
identified. The duty of the department to make all reasonable efforts to provide Mr. Jackson reasonably available services.
And the court was aware of the efforts that the social worker had made and what the record said was available. Is that awareness and the consideration of that compliance with the statute requiring them to be not just dismissed on incarceration?
I think the duty is more than just a cursory, you know, sending emails and phone calls about what generic services does your facility offer. You know, I think the social worker testified she wasn't even familiar with this 2013
law. But your previous point was that the court just ignored this, that the state, number one, didn't offer it, and two, the court, the purpose is so the court doesn't ignore it. The court did consider incarceration and did take the testimony under consideration, did it not, as to what was offered?
It did take into consideration the testimony. You know, I'd like to sort of shift the court's focus a little bit, if the court's interested in the due process issues I've raised in my briefing. You know, to address the second due process issue about notice of deficiencies, in this case, the trial court found that Mr. Jackson had five deficiencies, and I quote, substance abuse, domestic violence, lack of stability, lack of experience parenting, and refusal to follow orders. Now, those last three, Mr. Jackson had no notice of in either the petition to terminate or the order of dependency. And under this court's opinion in AMM and Division III's opinion in FMO, that's a violation of due process to terminate his parental rights on unalleged parental deficiencies.
You say that he had no notice.
Correct.
Is that based solely on the fact that the petition did not specifically identify that, or is there some other basis?
It's based on the entire record, Your Honor.
So your contention is that he never knew about
these deficiencies were raised at the first time at trial by the social worker and the guardian ad litem who testified about why termination was appropriate. They cited his lack of homelessness.
And was there an objection to that testimony at trial?
There was not an objection to that testimony at trial.
So you're familiar with the principle that the court may amend the pleadings to conform to the evidence, correct?
Correct.
And why doesn't that principle apply here?
Well, the department never moved to amend the pleadings at the end of the trial.
Is that necessary?
I think to provide notice, yes. And in the AMM and FMO case did not think that that would be. I mean, didn't discuss such a procedure, and the state hasn't raised this argument that Your Honor is making, so I mean,
I'm not making arguments, I'm just asking questions.
So, I mean, I think you'd have to amend the pleadings to provide notice of what the deficiencies are. I mean, here the trial court accepted the testimony from the department and then terminated based on these five deficiencies. And normally the proper remedy is remand. However, given my claim that there was an unconstitutional risk of bias on the part of the judge, that's not appropriate, and the appropriate remedy is a remand for a new trial. I see my time's expired.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Kelly Taylor. I'm an assistant attorney general on behalf of the Department of Social and Health Services, Children's Administration. And the department is asking this court to affirm termination as to the child, SJAV.
What about this notice issue?
So there was no violation of due process in terms of the notice that the father received of his parental deficiencies in this case. The stability, the lack of stability, there were three what I'm calling extraneous types of parental deficiencies that were in one of the findings, one of the many findings that the trial court made. These were the lack of stability, the lack of experience parenting, and the failure to follow orders. Now, the first one, the lack of stability, was an identified parental deficiency in the termination petition itself. CP 11, the termination petition states, the parents have not provided the children with a stable home in the past. They have not demonstrated the ability or the commitment to provide the children with a stable home currently, and they will not be able to do so in the near future. That same portion of the petition, CP 11, goes on to state, the children have a right to be raised in a stable, permanent home environment. So this issue of lack of stability for the children was identified in the termination petition at CP 11. The issue of lack of stability is also an issue that was encompassed with this other larger issue involving the father's incarceration. Incarceration was identified in the dependency order. It was also referenced in the termination petition, and it certainly has a bearing on stability of the children and the father's ability to provide a stable home for the children. The termination petition did not mention the exact phrases regarding lack of parenting and failure to follow orders. But the dependency order and the termination petition did provide notice as to larger concepts which encompass those lesser deficiencies. For example, lack of parenting experience in the dependency order It states that the father was not available to be assessed as an appropriate caregiver. So this gave notice regarding this lack of parenting experience. In terms of refusal to follow orders, it's clear from the trial court's oral comments that this was a reference to the larger issue of domestic violence perpetration. The father had a domestic violence and no contact order in place with the mother, and the courts in the oral ruling stated that he was primarily concerned about problems with not following no contact orders. So this is a reference to this larger deficiency of domestic violence perpetration. There is no manifest constitutional error in this case, and this case is distinguishable from this court's ruling in AMM. There was no actual prejudice here. The court did not consider this issue was not raised below, and it should not be considered for the first time on appeal because the actual elements of termination were not impacted by these extraneous parental deficiencies. When one thinks about the AMM case in AMM, the trial court stated that the parental deficiencies had not been corrected and identified a parental deficiency that the parent had not received notice of. That's not the case in SJAV, because in SJAV, the necessary services finding was based on the reasonable efforts that the social worker made to try to get services in place for the father. The little likelihood element was based on the father's long-term incarceration.
But wasn't the father due to be released within 2 years, then some halfway time?
That's right. So, and that's why the court found the little likelihood element was proven in this case. If you look at finding fact 2.39, the little likelihood element was based on the unavailability of the parent until at least July 2017, a date not within the child's near future. So that reference to the child's near future is a reference.
You're basing that on the age of this child? If this child were, 11, would we still be looking at the same result here?
This court needs to defer, I think, to the trial court's determination of the child's near future. This was a young child. If the child was 11, certainly the child's near future, the trial court could have found it to be longer than the 2 years that the father still had on his prison sentence.
Well, one of the issues here is that the termination hearing trial gets set shortly after they locate him at Walla Walla. Now, leaving aside, he could have notified the social worker. In terms of providing services, there was only a several-month window to provide services. There wasn't any realistic likelihood the department was going to deliver services adequate, whether he was incarcerated or not, when there was 3 months between his notice and the trial. We see many cases where the department's delivering services for well over a year.
That's true. But in this case, there was some aspect of futility to providing the father with services. But
in this case, you waited. It was 45 days, I think, from the time you first had contact with or learned he was incarcerated until you moved to terminate the requirement that you provide services to him. A mere 45 days. I mean, is that really enough time to have investigated what's available in terms of services?
The very same day the social worker found out that this person was in Walla Walla, she sent a service letter to him that very same day. And she asked him to let her know who his counselor was. And that same period of time, she contacted that counselor in Walla Walla. She found out that the court-ordered services were not available at that prison. So she found out that domestic violence batterers treatment was not available in Walla Walla. She found out that the chemical dependency treatment was not available to him in Walla Walla.
You think there's any obligation on the department to try to find services that might be available to parents that are incarcerated? Or try to find outside folks who are able to get inside the jail to deliver some of these services. I didn't see any efforts to find those kind of services for Mr. Jackson.
Well, by statute, as part of the permanent plan for the child, the department is to determine what resources are available within the facility where an incarcerated parent is resident.
And that would include outside folks coming into the jail, right?
That's not what the statute says. The statute says available within that facility. So
whatever is available to him is solely determined by the institution itself, and the department has no role in that. Is that your position?
Well, that's not a fact that's before that. That's not an issue before the court in this case, because this social worker did try to see if it was possible to bring outside providers into the jail facility, the detention facility. She contacted Mr. Albertson at Cedar Creek Correctional Facility. She asked specifically whether it was. She asked specifically whether are there providers that come to Cedar Creek to provide services? That's Exhibit 100. So the social worker is emailing the father's correctional
office. But this occurred after the motion to terminate services, for one thing. But what about at Walla Walla? Did she make the same inquiries at Walla Walla?
She did. She made the same inquiries at Walla Walla. And she got a response. Per DOC policies, we cannot provide substance abuse treatment until the offender is within 1 year to early release. And then in terms of outside providers, the response in the email was, I do not know what that picture would look like. Then she inquired about DV evaluations and parenting evaluations. And the social worker, you know, she testified that she was led to believe that the prison wouldn't welcome outside service providers. And that's her testimony at RP 372. So...
Do you think there's any obligation on the department to I mean, it's clear the legislature has some interest in making sure incarcerated parents get some services and an opportunity to reunite with their children.
Right.
Does the department have any obligation to try to develop some means of creating these services and making these services available?
Well, each case is driven by the specific facts of that case. And there are cases where if a parent is facing long-term incarceration, then it is futile.
That's not this case, though.
In terms of a young child's near future, this was long-term incarceration.
But this is not a case where, you know, he's looking at 25 years in prison or 5 years in prison or 15 years. I mean, it's a relatively short period of time that he's going to be incarcerated. And I'm just wondering whether or not you think the department has any obligation to try to develop some cadre of individuals who provide these kind of services and work with the prison institution to try to develop something that allows services to be presented instead of simply accepting the idea that there's nothing available and so we're going to move to terminate the obligation to provide services.
I think there are factual scenarios where the department social worker should be determining whether outside providers can come into the prison. I don't think that was the facts supported by this case. And if I could just make a concluding remark about the motion for discretionary review.
Only that.
Okay. That order, that purported to relieve the Department of the obligation to provide services, didn't alter the status quo in this case, because what the record shows in this case is that the social worker before that order was entered and after that order was entered reached out to the jail facilities to see what services were available and tried to provide reasonable efforts for this father to engage in services. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
The Supreme Court's recent opinion in DLB states that, you know, the department has the duty to provide all reasonably available services, period. As to the futility doctrine, the Supreme Court's recent opinion in BP says that means futility refers to when the parent repeatedly refused an offer of services. Mr. Jackson was never offered services by the department during this dependency. You know, to shift gears back sort of to the due process issue, the rule is that the department has to, prefer the specific allegations of the deficiencies, not these sort of like, you know, these broad generalities. So the parent needs to have notice of the specific bases for termination. And here the trial court found three of them, which were not alleged. And that's a violation of due process. And the courts in AMM and FMO, they review these issues despite them not being raised for the first time at trial, presumably.
He was not unaware of the facts. You're just saying he was unaware that the court might look at those facts and say he wasn't eligible.
Correct. I mean, had he been notified of this, his attorney might have acted differently, you know, and asked his client, you know, do you have the experience, babysitting or acting as a caregiver, you know, if they're talking about your lack of parenting experience, you know, if you're talking about your, you know, the case might have been completely different. I mean, that's why you get to have notice of the specific allegations of deficiency so you can address them.
Wasn't he told that he would need parenting classes or should get parenting classes?
No, he was ordered to give a parenting assessment, and then
he didn't do, which was the precursor
That order of dependency happened, and that's another thing the department gets wrong, is he was incarcerated, and then the order of dependency was entered. About a week after his incarceration, he defaulted that. And and then, supposedly, the department didn't know where he was, and then when they finally discovered where he was, they didn't offer him any services. They moved to remove their duty to provide services, so he was never provided a parenting assessment.
Do all of those issues fall away if we find that the child was so young that his release date wasn't within the reasonable time for the child? I mean, because that would trump everything, wouldn't it?
Well, it wouldn't trump my due process arguments. If the court determines there is substantial evidence on the foreseeable future and the near future elements, that Your Honor's analysis might be correct. But they don't defeat my arguments that he was entitled to an unbiased judge, that he was entitled to notice of the deficiencies, that the trial court, that it was inappropriate for the trial court to mix in the best interest of the child inquiry into its analysis on current parental unfitness. Those issues require reversal regardless of that. So I'd ask this court to reverse termination order and to instruct the court to reinstate his visitation services.
Thank you, counsel. The next matter is termination.